The Big Red Bench. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m. Cork's Red FM.
The Joanne O'Riordan Podcast. A Big Red Bench production for Cork's Red FM.
Hi, welcome back to the Joanne O'Riordan Podcast with me, Joanne O'Riordan. Coming up today, we've got part two of my interview with inspirational climber and absolute trailblazer, Claire Sheridan, where she'll continue telling us what it's like to climb the highest peaks in Europe and across the world. And she'll also detail a very interesting story about how she and her fellow female colleagues go to the toilet when they're on the mountains. Tune in and enjoy.
I was going to say, I assume that when you're actually finding a whole other kind of way to climb up another kind of, mountain or whatever, like that, when you find a whole new way to kind of climb up there, I assume that's another whole level of adrenaline again on top of it.
Yes, yeah, and different cliffs, different types of rock require different strategies to climb and skills to climb. And what many climbers nowadays begin to learn to climb on indoor climbing walls, and there's a lot of really good climbing walls around the country, and but the climbing walls tend to develop a specific type of climbing only. And then sometimes when you get out onto the natural rock, you find that there are cracks which you don't normally find on the indoor climbing walls, and maybe even what we call chimneys, where you squirm in with your whole body. So there's great variety of climbing, and it's great being able to travel to different cliffs, to different countries, and explore all of these and the different demands they make on your climbing skill and on your body. So it's next year, 2021, it will be 50 years since I started climbing, and it's still really exciting. And the possibilities of exploration are as wide as they've ever been. So I've just found that it's a marvelous sport that has made a huge difference to my life.
What has been like the bunch of stuff you've learned, I suppose, within that 49 years of climbing, both, I suppose, from a personal point of view, like things you've learned about yourself, like things you've learned that you can apply to life, and then things about climbing. What have been like the most standout things for you?
I suppose that I'm a lot stronger psychologically than perhaps I would have ever thought. When I was young, my sister Barbara, who figures in my book, we were together in a lot of adventures. She was older. She was brave and louder than me, and everybody noticed her. And because she had a kind of dominant role, I was the quiet little sister, and I was always the good girl, whereas she always tended to push the limits. You play roles in families. And it was really only as, I suppose, I came into my late teens and started climbing that I realized, no, I was strong too, and I had strengths, perhaps different strengths. The demands that climbing made on me and the fact that I could manage them, I felt gave me confidence in other parts of my life. Yeah, I'd say that's definitely true, because the intensity of managing yourself physically and psychologically when you're hanging off the rock in a steep, difficult situation with the prospect of maybe quite a big fall below you. Now, I'm not talking about hitting the ground, but, you know, maybe swinging around and bashing something on the rock. Not the kind of fall you want to make. To be able to keep relatively calm and climb out of that situation and manage the whole thing and manage yourself, that's really, really empowering.
Yeah, and even, like, you know, from a whole, like, woman point of view, like, I'm sure there were plenty of climbs that you undertook that actually, because even in your book, when you were talking about like the ratings, like they were created for like men.
That's
and
true.
Like really, really technical climbs, you know, where you need maybe like tiny slim fingers or just bodies that could kind of bend a bit more than a male body. Like I'm sure like you even see now like that. Is there now like a grading system maybe for female climbers, like for women, or are they still basing it off of like what Joe down the road thinks?
Well, the way it works, when a person climbs a piece of rock that has never been climbed before, they have the privilege of they describe the climb, exactly where it goes and the kind of climbing that's involved. They put the grade of difficulty on it, and they name it. All those things are what, and then it goes into a guidebook. And I've done so. It's the person generally who, as we call it, puts up the climb or does the first ascent, who puts those judgments really on it, and then they're in the guidebook. And I've done thousands of climbs in my climbing career, and I'd say I've only done less than half a dozen that were ever put up by women. So yes, it's still men who are doing that. Now, sometimes the editor of a guidebook will be a sort of moderator and may change the grade of a climb, or if the climb has been climbed a lot and a lot of people say, oh, it's overgraded or it's undergraded, then that'll be changed. But no, broadly speaking, it would generally still be men who would do first ascents and who would put the grade of difficulty on a climb. But having said that, because so many female climbers now train indoors very efficiently, women, female climbers are a lot stronger. The gap between men's strength and women's strength as climbers is an awful lot narrower than it was when I started in 1971. So it's not as much of an issue anymore.
Yeah. And I was going to say, like, you said you've gone through thousands and thousands of climbs. Mm-hmm. What has been, I suppose you probably have a couple, right, that are probably like standout for very different reasons. So like what for you, like would have been your kind of peak highlight? Obviously your first is going to be a highlight because it's the first, nothing can replace the first, but like, you know, is there other stuff as well in between where you're like, you know, you kind of lay in bed, you're like, God, remember when I scaled that? God, that was great crack now. Or God, there was such a sense of satisfaction when I got up to the top there. Like, which of them have kind of done it for you?
Yeah, well, yes, there would be particular climbers that would really kind of stick out more than others. My first climb of a particular grade, very severe on Glendalough Cliff years ago in my early days climbing, because very severe was a grade of difficulty which was taken very seriously at the time, and there were not that many men, much less women in Ireland, who climbed that grade when I started climbing. So it was a big watershed moment for me to succeed on a very severe climb on that cliff. That was a big deal. That was probably the biggest breakthrough I had. Now, VS is considered relatively easy nowadays, but it was a really big deal then. And a bit like getting up on top of the swing, I didn't know if I could do it, but I couldn't let it rest. I had to check it out. And it was scary. So doing it and succeeding and thinking back on it, that was huge. And of course, that was really only the beginning of a lot of climbing where I wanted to climb harder and harder things. Some of the climbs, I suppose, that have given me most satisfaction have been new routes on the big cliff at Fairhead in Antrim, where Calvin, my husband, and I have done, maybe hundreds of new climbs over the years. It's a very formidable, it's over 100 metres high for about much of its length, about 4 kilometres. You can't really see it clearly from the bottom because it's very rough at the bottom. You can't walk in. So you abseil in, and the only good views of it really are either filmed from a drone or but from boats. It's up the Sea of Moyle near Rathlin Island on the Antrim coast. So it's a place set apart, and when you're at the bottom of it, it's big and dark and intimidating because it's north facing. But over the years, I've got very familiar with it, and we've both done very good climbs there. I would, you know, my climbs would be ones that I would have led the hardest pitches on, and Calvin's climbs would be ones that he has led the hardest section on, even if we shared parts of the climb. So, yeah, probably the climbs I'd be most proud of would be my own routes that I spotted, you know, a possibility. I cleaned the vegetation out of cracks and got rid of loose rock and climbed this piece of rock that no one had ever climbed before, from the boulders at the bottom right up to the very top of the cliff, and then gave it a name, wrote it up for the guidebook. So in inverted commas, it's mine. So that would be a high point, all right, so for me, new climbs yeah. that I've done.
Yeah, and I was going to say, like, did you also enjoy the fact that, you know, that you could share them with someone else? You know, you had your sister when you were younger, you know, then you'd friends, and now you have your husband. Was that not a big motivator, but was it, like, just nice that you could kind of sit at the top of a rock climb and just of a hill and just kind of maybe watch, I don't know, like, the world kind of go by, like, you, because it's just you, I suppose, in that moment, you know, like, there's no one else around you, literally.
that's right. I mean, climbing with someone is a very bonding experience anyway, because you have to totally trust them that they will hold the rope if you fall, whether they're at the bottom belaying is anchoring the rope for you as you climb, or whether they're at the top and you're the second person coming up. You've got to trust each other. But it's not just sharing the moment, it's practical as well. Climbing tends to take a lot of time, and people would typically go away for a full day or for a full weekend, and that's very hard on family life. And we would know many young climbers where the couples, where both the guy and the girl are really keen, and then a bit later on they have children. Obviously, it's very difficult to, and we had our own difficulties working things out when you've got kids to look after and so on. And even more difficult if only one of the couple is into climbing, you know, taking time off from the family at the weekend. That's not on really a lot of the time. So for us to always have a climbing partner to be able to depend on, and not to be putting a relationship under strain by one or other of us going off for a weekend, that sustained both of us over the decades. And obviously, when our children were young, we took turns climbing, but we were each totally supportive of the other's climbing, and that made all the difference, particularly to me, I feel, because as always was traditionally the case, the man always not necessarily took more time away, but just the way things worked out, it would have more usually been the mother who would have stayed with the children rather than the father. And so it was really important to me that our partnership was equal, to the extent that I could go away as easily as Calvin could go away and the other one look after the children.
Yeah, it's that weird kind of social thing that even exists, like, today.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the husband or the father is great for minding the children, but no one really says anything when the mom is there, like, 24/7 for, like, you know, Monday to Friday. Did you find things were a little bit trickier? Like, you know, you brought up children there and you said it was great, you had kind of the support, but did you find kind of going away, you know, for a long time, you know, either Calvin going away or you going away, did you find things a bit more kind of like stressful once you had children? Like, was it a case of, okay, don't be too risky, like, you know, you don't want any kind of bad situation to kind of come along, like, for both you or Calvin? Like, were you a bit more cautious, or were you both like, look, we've been doing this for years, like, it is what it is?
Well, you know, it's kind of a combination of the two. I suppose when you're climbing, you do minimize the risk. You're never reckless, and even more so when you have kids at home, of course. And we very rarely climb together in the Alps, say. where there are more risks, very rarely after the children were born. Well, we didn't have the option. You couldn't just pick up a babysitter in an alpine campsite anyhow. But the odd thing was when the boys were young, when they were quite young, I was very happy to leave them with Calvin to go off and do my own thing, and always presumed that I'd come back to them safely and happily, very happily. I mean, there was definitely being able to continue to climb meant that they had a very happy mother compared to a frustrated mother if I hadn't been able to climb.
Yeah.
But then as I got older, I found it played on my mind just a bit more. Just a little. And then there was one occasion when I was setting off to do a big climb in the Alps, and Calvin was staying with the boys, and it was early morning, and we were all in the one tent in this alpine campsite, and I had everything ready to go, and then I hear this little voice from the tent, "Claire, don't go. I can't remember what your face looks like." And it was our youngest, who was 6 at the time, and it just twisted my heart. But I had an arrangement made with another climber to meet him and to set off from the climb. And I wasn't going to change my mind at that stage, but that was very difficult to go in to the 6-year-old and say, no, don't worry, I'll be back. Here I am and I'll be back. It did kind of stop me in my tracks. But I knew that it was important for me as a person to have the freedom to do what I loved, what I was passionate about. And I felt, as I was writing the book, my mother's story kind of appeared shadowing mine. On so many occasions, looking back, I realized she had never had the chance to make choices. She was a housewife and mother of 7. Mm. And her spirit was restricted all through the years when her children were young, and my sister and I were the eldest, and there were 5 more after us, and you know, it was decades before she had any chance to do anything she might have been passionate about. So, and I know the toll, well, I don't really know, but I kind of can guess the toll that took on her personally and emotionally. So I just felt privileged that I could do what I really wanted to do, even when I was a mother.
Yeah, and I was going to say, like, even the way you were talking there, it's almost like, it's not that rock climbing is your sole identity, because obviously, like every other person, there's so many kind of layers and identities to you. You know, you've got Claire the mom, you've got Claire the rock climber, Claire who probably goes out and does the talk. Even in rock climbing alone, you probably have so many different personalities. Like, do you, and you were saying, like, you're eternally grateful you weren't in the time where, like, as you were saying, your own mother just had to be a housewife. Like, do you think that was down to your sheer determination to just shed all desire to be that woman who will just sit in the corner and say yes, no? Because I was laughing at the story of when your sister Barbara went to nun school and just came back and was like, yeah, I can't do it. Let's go rock climbing instead.
Well, that's more or less how it happened. And Barbara was such a strong-spirited girl that nobody was surprised that she didn't stick the convent for very long. I don't know. I mean, I never would have seen myself as strongly spirited. She, as I say, she was the one. But I suppose there was a quiet determination that came through. And climbing was just so amazing for us. It just gave us such a feeling of exaltation that we hadn't had in life before, that just things fell into place for me. I suppose I had a certain level of climbing ability that heightened my interest and meant that I stuck with it and got stronger, got better, and got a lot of payback for it from it. And you know, there was a certain sense as well that I was the only woman in Ireland doing, you know, this at this level at the time. And, you know, that was, I suppose, a good boost in motivation as well. But no, that wasn't what was important. It was the experience of being able to get out of the house, to go away from the classroom, because I was a teacher, for primary teacher for 38 years, and do my own thing, even if it seemed, well, like many sporting things, seemed perhaps a bit pointless. But it was such fun, and I got such enjoyment out of it that I feel so lucky that I've had access to it all the way along.
Yeah, I mean, you've literally broken down barriers, I think, for so many different people and set like a precedent and a standard that definitely wouldn't have been there. You know, I think it probably would have taken maybe a couple more years, you know, for that equal, not even just equality, but just more for the whole, like for another woman to kind of trailblaze like you did. Like, you were like definitely ahead of your time in that regard.
I was. And I suppose it was a help that I wasn't hung up on what other people's view of me might be. You know, I did sort of think that given the times that were in it in the 70s, that people must think, I'm sure they did, that I was very unfeminine because women, girls just didn't do this sort of thing, certainly not in Ireland. But I didn't care. I really didn't care. I suppose the people I moved amongst, I was lucky in that there was no peer pressure to do otherwise. I didn't feel sucked into the traditional view of what perhaps some people might have thought I should have been doing at the time. You know, getting a job. Well, I did do that. Getting a husband, having kids. I mean, I didn't have children until I was in my 30s, which was a little bit later than the average at the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, and this is just something that when I was reading the book, a part of me was like, oh God, will I ask her or will I not ask her? And you touched on it briefly in the book, which was like toileting. Like in my head, right? I need a toilet, okay? Not to be this weirdo. But like as a girl with just a load of lads, because I mean, I train football teams and like, you know, I see them obviously taking a whiz in the bank next door, you know, and things like that.
Yeah.
Like for a girl, like obviously you just got to do what you got to do in situations like that. But, you know, obviously for other kind of woman, you know, issues that exist, you know, obviously like periods and stuff every month, like that, when you were rock climbing and you had to tap your pockets a couple of times to make sure there was tampons, like different things like that. I suppose you couldn't really tell anyone about them at the time. You just kind of had to roll with it, did you?
Exactly. You just had to be well organized. And no, of course you couldn't mention them. And there was never another woman around that I could, you know, compare notes with. It's actually a huge issue. And I'm glad you've mentioned it, because it has kind of been unmentionable. And periods, yes, and being prepared for that, but also just having a pee. You know, it's so much a bigger deal for women in the outdoors than it is for men. And I think it probably does put some women off being out in the mountains, hill walking, being out all day, because of the awkwardness of looking after things. And it's a shame, and it's a particular I mean, that incident you mentioned when I was patting my pocket to make sure that I had brought tampons, I mean, that really was a challenging situation. You know, it was halfway up a Himalayan peak on a steep snow slope, and there were five of us tied together, just an arm length apart, all tied to the same anchor point on some rock. And yeah, and in our climbing harnesses. And yeah, but what am I going to do now? I have to go to the toilet. And I literally had to ask the others just to turn the other way and organize myself. And then there was the safety aspect, because I was anchored to the mountain through my climbing harness, and climbing harnesses are not designed for women. They just aren't. Well, perhaps perhaps there isn't another way of doing it, but you know, you actually have to take the whole thing off. And if you do, that's your connection with the mountain gone. But, you know, I had to tie on separately with the rope. I managed, of course, in ways it wasn't a big deal. But you know, it is a big deal because everybody likes to be private. And it's difficult. It is difficult.
I was going to say, it's definitely like a part of you, like you were saying in like Catholic school, you learned to be prim and proper, like let alone expose yourself on a side of a mountain to go to the toilet. So I'm sure that went against not every like mental grain, but I'm sure, like, do you know the way we always kind of joke about this weird Catholic guilt that exists in a lot of Irish people? Like, I'm sure even for you, probably the first time you had to go on a mountainside, you were like, this is awkward.
you're absolutely right. I mean, being ladylike didn't come naturally to me, and never has. At the same time, though, it is. You feel embarrassed. There's no easy way out of it, and you just have to do your best.
Even the thought of unstrapping yourself from like the main safety anchor, just you'd be like, oh, can I hold it? Can I, you know, you're going through that weird mental thought process that you probably should never do. You should just let it go, guys.
Yeah.
but for the future, like, you know, you were saying 2021, you're 50 years climbing. Is there any big climb that you haven't done yet that you want to do? I know I read in some article you'd done maybe 6 or 7 years ago that Everest is not on your real agenda. It doesn't really bother you.
That's right.
So is there any other place that would definitely tickle your fancy?
Well, there would still be climbs. Obviously, everything depends on freedom to travel with the pandemic, but also like anybody else who has the freedom to travel, I would feel guilty at traveling too much because of for environmental issues. But they're whatever about big mountains. You know, they do take their toll on the body as you get older, and knees get a bit creakier. But so big mountains, no, I don't see myself committing to something on big, you know, on Himalayan peaks. But there are still closer to home in the Alps in North America. There are still and in Morocco, and indeed perhaps in areas in the Himalayas that don't necessarily involve it's long, tricky descents that tend to take their toll, I must say. Whereas rock climbing, it's great. I can still rock climb. I can still train. I can still feel that I'm getting stronger. And there's still lots and lots of very steep climbs that I'm keen to do. Shorter ones, obviously, in Ireland, and big rocky peaks in the Alps. And the last couple of years, we've been to Morocco a few times, and there's fantastic possibilities there. So there's lots to look at, lots of guidebooks and maps to take out. Enough to keep inspired by.
Keep you thinking. And for any young girl who maybe is thinking of getting into climbing or anything like that, like, I mean, considering you're like one of the main pioneers for climbing and for women climbing in Ireland, like, what would be your key things you want them to know in advance? Obviously, make sure you know how to go to the toilet might be one. But, you know, is there any for you that you feel, okay, like if I had my time back, this is what I would tell younger Claire?
Yeah, well, there's two distinct styles of climbing in a way, to the extent that some areas have a lot of bolted climbs, but Ireland has a lot of what are called trad or traditional cliffs where there are no bolts. Now, I won't get into all the differences between those, but I would say to people who begin climbing at indoor walls and become very adept at clipping bolts and climbing to high standards, don't just stick with the bolt climbing, which is called sport climbing. try the traditional climbing, the trad climbing, where you come to the bottom of the cliff, you check the guidebook, you do a climb. There are no bulls in the cliff. You are engaging with the rock in its natural state. It's more demanding, but you get more satisfaction out of it. I mean, the bull climbing, sport climbing, definitely great for raising standards and training and pushing yourself. But there's a whole variety of other skills needed to manage yourselves competently and safely on the cliffs that don't have bolts on them. And it's worth building up the expertise for that type of climbing as well, because, as I say, it's more demanding psychologically, but you get a lot more out of it. So that's what I would say to anyone nowadays. Don't just be channeled into sport climbing, into clipping bolts as you go. Keep your options open. Learn all the skills involved to climb on all the Irish cliffs, very, very, very few of which have bolts on them. So, yeah, use what you inherit on this island and you'll get such a payback from it.
That's good. No, and thanks very much for joining me on the podcast. No, I really appreciate your time, Claire. Really do appreciate it.
You're welcome, Joanne. I've enjoyed it.
That was part two of my interview with the inspirational woman that is Claire Sheridan. She's an absolute inspiration and she's a trailblazer for all Irish women, not just athletes, but everyone who is looking to aspire to do something great. Coming up next week, we've got an incredible interview with Irish international rugby star Eimear Considine, where she'll talk to us about what it was like to go into rugby despite having only a GAA background and how she's managed to climb to the top of the rugby world. Tune in next week and enjoy. And don't forget to follow us all on social media at JoannaOr_OX and at Big Red Bench. And also don't forget to stay safe. I know it's an incredibly difficult time for people at the minute. And I know for the next 6 weeks it's going to be hard. But we are going to keep going with this podcast to keep you company throughout these incredibly tough and lonely times. So we hope you do join us in these wonderful conversations. And if you want to listen back, feel free at any time. Thanks very much for joining us and tune in next week for Eimear Considine.
The Big Red Bench. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m. Cork's Red FM.